Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 2, 9:30 a.m., Friday, November 14th, 1969, Room 315, State Capitol Building. Today's subject, criminal homicide, preliminary draft number 1.
Turn over to George, I guess.
Okay, I move the adoption of the...
All right, is there a second? All those in favor, we'll serve on purpose. Carl?
Get back, play some more football.
Yeah.
Let me get my legs crossed here.
Okay.
First section does not contain anything startling, except that it does alert us to the fact that there aren't going to be degrees in this draft, at least at this point, in murder, and that there will be a new crime, in a sense, one that exists now but in a different language, of criminally negligent homicide. There will only be three branches, then, of homicide, be murder, manslaughter, or criminally negligent homicide. A note on the definition of human being, this eliminates from the operation of this article the abortion law, which the Model Penal Code treats elsewhere as a less serious offense. Now, I believe we're going to also treat it elsewhere, and I don't think there's any conflict between this article and that abortion provision. Don, this human being definition may or may not clash with any definitions elsewhere. Do you know if it does?
No, I don't think it does, George.
I think it does either. I'll go on, I guess. I do notice in my draft, I say in sub 1, a person commits the crime of criminal homicide. I wonder if we just can't simply say a person commits criminal homicide if he causes. Mm-hmm. And unless I hear objections, I think that'll just take the words the crime of.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, I'll go on into section 2, if that's the desire of the chair.
Proceed, you're doing good, thanks.
Now, now we begin to get into the substance, of course, and the changes which are noteworthy under the murder section. Number 1, we have a major change with respect to the felony murder doctrine. And secondly, we are abolishing the degrees of murder. Those are the two substantial changes from our existing law, which of course has murder 1 and 2 now in Oregon. And the provisions for felony murder are the traditional provisions that exist in most states. That is, first, rape, robbery, arson, and one kidnapping, I guess, and death arising out of those crimes gives rise to the felony murder doctrine in the first degree in Oregon, and then there's a second degree felony murder doctrine. All other felonies which might result in death are the second degree murder. With respect to the second degree provision, that's going to be eliminated entirely, but we are retaining the concept of first degree felony murder in that subparagraph 1C of section 2 provides that it's murder if the death results while a person is committing, and now I list several crimes here and I list them all in the first degree, and this is purely an arbitrary setting out on my part because I'm not aware entirely of whether some of these crimes are going to be in degrees. Some of them I know are, so this is going to take some adjustment of a technical nature, but roughly they include burglary, escape, kidnapping, rape, that's forcible rape, robbery, forcible sodomy. Sodomy in the first degree, I think, is the forcible brand, isn't it, in our definition?
Yes.
That's what's intended here, the forcible crimes, the very dangerous kind of crimes.
It'd be either forcible or with a victim less than 12 years old.
Some adjustment may be necessary in the whether it's first degree in each case, but I think that would be a technical one which the staff could adjust later if in fact the substance is agreed to in this existing draft. Now, I notice that there's a typographical omission in subparagraph C about the sixth line down. It says course of and in furtherance of the crime should be and. With the felony murder doctrine, the change here is that there's going to be a defense created for those people who are committing one of these serious violent kinds of crimes, that is robbery, armed robbery, where a death ensues. This is a very limited defense, and it follows the new New York code. It is different from the model penal code also. First, the provision here is that if the person is committing this crime with others, that's a basically, there's got to be somebody else involved, and someone else actually must be the cause of the death. That is, the person who's raising the defense under this provision may not raise the defense if he, in fact, causes the death. The other specifics of the defense are set out in sub 2, and you'll notice they're quite voluminous, really. He's got a very tough way to go. In the first place, he hasn't reasonable grounds that no one else was planning to kill anyone. He wasn't using a deadly weapon. Did not commit the homicidal act himself and was not the only participant in one or two others. Now, I suppose I ought to point out the difference here from the model penal code approach. Model penal code provides murder consists of the reckless killing of another with extreme indifference to the value of life. That's their definition of murder, which we're roughly following here. But it then goes on to say that it is presumed to be murder if the death results from one of the forcible felonies, rape, robbery, pretty much the same ones here. Now that's a little different, of course. You can see there's a presumption, in other words, that the person has committed murder if it arises out of the listed felony. The presumption is rebuttable by the defendant, but it does not specify the aspects of what he must show in order to have a successful defense. It is, in that sense, more flexible, I suppose. The model penal code defense is more flexible and is somewhat broader, I would assume. But obviously, any defendant who is raising this kind of a defense to murder is going to be looked on with extreme disbelief, I would assume, by most juries. So he's not. I don't think this is the kind of defense which is going to be raised successfully very often. But I think it should be a part of the homicide and certainly the murder statute, because we have approached the outer limits of the mens rea requirements with respect to murder in the felony murder doctrine. And in effect, what we have is strict liability. One who sets out to commit a lesser felony with no mens rea, with no mental element of intending to kill anyone, winds up as a murderer. Now, that in most cases will still continue to be the case because of the way we've got it drafted, but there will be a door through which the very unusual defendant will be able to exit from the charge of murder. Now, this doesn't mean that he's going to escape the underlying felony, nor does it mean that he can't perhaps be committed of a lesser homicide, his reckless participation in this kind of thing, or his criminally negligent participation in this kind of a proceeding. But it will be a defense for him in murder. Now, are there any questions at this point? I want to discuss the degrees of murder, and then I think that the section would be summed up. With respect to degrees, I point out in my comment that this is one of the metaphysical aspects of a homicide that I think no longer serves a function. The difference between first and second degree murder is really metaphysical, I think. The cases in Oregon and the cases generally throughout the country indicate that any premeditation, an instant before the offense, the death act, or very few moments before the death act, is long enough to fall within the premeditated murder doctrine, first degree. And the difference between that and reckless homicide is very difficult, I think, for juries to deal with, and really an impractical standard. Secondly, and even more important, determining what factors make murder more serious than others is, I think, also a kind of a mythical exercise, because example I use, I don't know whether it's an apt one or not, where the individual, in reaction to protecting his home against the dolorous relations of his wife with her lover, the kind of one-time emotional trauma in this one man's life, and he kills as a result. He's a perfectly safe and sane citizen before and after this act, and yet he's premeditated that murder and is guilty of first-degree murder. And you'd contrast him with the nut who fires the pistol into the crowd or puts the bomb on the airplanes. And kills a lot of people that he didn't intend to kill. And this is reckless homicide under our statutes. It is second degree murder. It's ridiculous. The two of the two, I think that the second is far more dangerous. And if we're going to attach a penalty that's more strenuous to anybody, it ought to be the one who's committed the lesser crime. Now, in this provision, by eliminating the degrees, we certainly haven't eliminated or eased the way in which we'll deal with those more dangerous, but I think we're putting it in the court to decide what penalty ought to be applied based on the dangerousness of the person involved, who's been convicted of murder now, just plain murder, and the how he ought to be dealt with on the facts of the case, not on whether it's first or second degree, but the fact that it's an extremely dangerous murder, and therefore he ought to be given a treatment far more exhaustive than the man who kills to protect the sanctity of his home.
George?
Yes.
What's the present penalty for first degree murder? Maximum is life. Mm-hmm. For second degree murder?
25 years, I think.
Yeah,
it is.
25. Sure.
And that's there can be anything up to 25.
Yeah.
In the first degree, it is an automatic life. Can't be any less, as I
that's right.
The statute.
So, if we, as I understand, everything that's presently excluded under second or presently second degree murder would be included under Section 2, just mm-hmm. as plain murder.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually giving the court the opportunity of an enhanced penalty for those who find themselves engaging in the conduct that we would now think of as second degree murder.
Mm-hmm. That's right. We wouldn't look at the technical
maximum.
Distinction of the crime. We'd look at that person and say, what has he done? What kind of personality is he? What kind of background and history does he have now? Because we've convicted him of murder. Now, as a sentencing authority, has this great flexibility, and I think that's the place to put it. Undoubtedly one of the only, not the only, but one of the three or four first degree felonies in the code, in the new code. It's one of the only three or four in the present model penal code. And I forget exactly what the top is on it. Do you know, Don, under the model penal code sentencing?
20 years.
20 or something.
But they have life imprisonment for murder. They provide for life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, they have an option in there for capital punishment, for mm-hmm. death penalty, depending on the state. But
it's another reason for ending the degree difference in Oregon, because we don't have capital punishment. Historically, that's why degree murder really started, to allow sympathy the jury to extend sympathy to someone that they didn't want to execute.
Now, this would have an effect when it comes to grading. I mean, our thinking has been that that our classification of felonies and our grading of our offenses within these categories of A, B, and C, we would be following the Model Sentencing Act and the ABA minimum standards approach to sentencing. For that matter, pretty much the Model Penal Code, because the Model Sentencing Act, for example, murder is the one crime that's punishable by life imprisonment. They have an atrocious crime type of provision, but the maximum penalty for most of their offenses under their code, under the Model Sentencing Act, except for murder, is 30 years. That's their outer limits. So Michigan, for example, which followed the Model Sentencing Act technique, pretty much, in their grading, went to 20 years as the maximum, so they didn't go as far as the Model Sentencing Act would allow. And this is what we were thinking, generally, that our maximum penalty for a Class A felony would be 20 years imprisonment, except for murder. And so I think we're going to have to keep this in mind, because I suppose it could be dealt with, even though your maximum is life imprisonment, because of our definition of murder, we could in our grading provisions, give the court an out to deal with it, you know, as, with a sentence of less than life imprisonment, if the court. But there's one other consideration we have to look at too. Murder under our present code is really the only crime that carries with it, in effect, a mandatory minimum sentence.
Well, I presume we're going to move away from that if this draft is contemplated.
Yeah, and this has it implicitly that there have to be flexibility in that.
Yeah, so I mean, these are things that we should have in mind as we look at this. I don't think it's any big obstacle, but I don't want us to fall into a trap here of grading this thing too severely, because you're in effect bringing in some second degree offenses. I mean, what we think of as second degree murder now within this definition of murder, and if we say, well, murder is punishable by life imprisonment, and let it go at that, then we're going to be enhancing the punishment for a.
Yet if we're not careful coming the other way, then we're going to lose a lot of the support.
Yeah,
like
right.
Brutos.
That's right.
You put him in the category, it's true that he could get out after 12 months, you know, but he won't. There wouldn't be a...
Of course, you're going to have that problem. And all you can do is hope that there aren't any Brutos cases while this is going on in the general way.
Yeah, I'm glad there wasn't trial while we tried while we were working on the sex trial.
Yeah. Well, a couple more observations about this thing. With respect to the defense to the felony murder aspect here, you note that I, in subparagraph 2 of the section, I designated this as an affirmative defense, which translated into English means that the defendant has a burden of introducing the issue and proving it by a preponderance of the evidence. Now, this is one of the places where this is unusual, of course, to put the burden on the defendant in any extent. The Model Penal Code does not do that under its presumption formula. It just simply leaves the burden as it is. That is the normal situation. The state ultimately would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty as charged. I suppose I put this in here because it is so unusual, and because there's likely to be a reaction against liberalization in this particular area. And I see no reason why this burden couldn't be placed with the defendant, because it is that kind of a sort of subjective kind of defense that no one knows as well as the defendant is going to know in introducing and proving it. It certainly will establish for a very few people a defense that didn't exist before. Now, you may want to choose the Model Penal Code approach. It's basically a little different policy, but both, of course, are opening up the felony murder doctrine, getting away from the old strict liability concept. And you may, of course, the third option is just to throw it out and retain the old felony murder rigidity of more or less strict liability. I would hope you don't do that.
George, I notice that this provision is taken from the New York statutes, which similarly put the burden of establishing defense to felony murder on the defendant. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any New York cases that have considered the constitutionality of this? What I'm getting at is that in 2.5 years in a district attorney's office, I heard I don't know how many defense attorneys tell juries, of course you realize that the defendant doesn't have to prove a thing here. And many will raise constitutionally. The burden of proof is entirely on the state in a criminal case. Now, I know of there's also a U.S. Supreme Court case which held that Oregon's old law relating to the burden of proof in insanity, mm-hmm. putting the burden on the defendant and proving it beyond a reasonable doubt, was all right. But that was 1952, I think. Has there been anything since?
Well, we've had a continuing discussion on this very issue with several things. It started with the responsibility article. And there's something to be said for that. I argue very strenuously with respect to the burden of proof and insanity that ought not to be on the defendant in any extent. But I lost that argument, and I can't. I don't think there's any way to say that it's constitutionally required, at least in the view of the present stature of the Leland versus Oregon. Now, we know, for instance, that the alibi which has been placed on, traditionally on the defendant to prove, has been challenged, and I think successfully, in the Circuit Court of Appeals, came out of an Iowa case, I forget where it was. Mm-hmm. And I think the United States Supreme Court declined certiorari on the case, I'm not entirely sure. But we are in an area of doubtful constitutional validity. But I still would go ahead on this basis. I'm really not very crazy about placing the preponderance on a defendant at any point. I find myself in sort of an anomalous position because of the stand that I've taken all the way along on responsibility. But I have, in the couple of the drafts that I've drawn up in inchoate crimes, placed the burden on the defendant with respect to some of these inchoate crimes aspects, withdrawal. I think in those places that there is less likelihood of any constitutional challenge because of the particular factual pattern in place at the trial in which it arises. Now, there may be some more problem with something like this.
Plus, I think there's this distinction that can be drawn between this kind of a defense and the one you have provided for here in court crimes and the defense of insanity, and that's this, that many of these factors are going to be particularly within the knowledge of the defendant. And it just doesn't seem that that's imposing any great hardship on the defendant to establish things that he himself would be the only one in a position to know.
Tom, I think you're right that if I were a defense lawyer, I'd insert the constitutional issue, but I'm not sure that I'd be successful. At least I agree with you that the point you raise is
absurd. George, what's the alibi you alluded to? The Supreme Court, did they hold the alibi?
No, I didn't hear the case. I think they declined certiorari.
But there is I believe, Eighth Circuit case. I think I know the case you're thinking of, and I don't know what it said exactly. It dealt with alibi and placing the burden of establishing the alibi on the defendant.
It's a sort of a half-and-half deal throughout the country again, just like insanity proof. Some states say alibi is to be proved not only the issue inserted by, but also proved by preponderance by the defendant. And the other states take the other view. The thing is that this is a defendant is claiming it's part of the mens rea element, and he can't place the burden on him because the state has proof that it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's an interesting doctrine, too, that beyond a reasonable doubt, there is no federal constitutional basis for that doctrine. There has never been. It isn't part of the Bill of Rights. There has never been a United States Supreme Court decision on it, with the exception of kind of around the edges in Leland versus Oregon. But it's a state doctrine by case law usually, and in Oregon by statute and case law, rising out of traditional concepts of due process. So we're talking about something that really the United States Supreme Court has never said is an element or is a constitutional right of a defendant. I have no doubt they would. I haven't been asked.
Are we all satisfied that the forcible crimes that George has listed and under 1C here pretty well pick up the crimes that to which we want to attach the felony murder rule? I can't think of any other.
I got a question about the same area. In C, George, 2C. Mm-hmm. Was not armed with a deadly weapon or any instrument, so on and so forth, of a sort not ordinarily carried in public places by law-abiding persons. I was wondering what that added to that to the section.
I'll go back a little bit. We have a deadly weapon definition somewhere, don't we, John?
Pardon me?
We have a deadly weapon definition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A dangerous weapon.
Yeah, do you want to hear it?
Yeah, and it may be that your point is well taken and we don't need some of this language. We'll now hear in dulcet tones Don Follett reading us chapter and verse.
If I can find it.
Come in, Don. Take it away, Don.
Mr. Follett is searching for the book. We'll pause for this word from our sponsor.
State of Oregon.
Right. Vote for
the vote to repeal the second paragraph.
Yes, general definition. This is under our preliminary article. Section 3. Deadly weapons defined as
meaning any instrument, article, or substance specifically designed for and presently capable of causing death or serious physical injury.
What about our, what's the next, isn't there another one?
And a dangerous weapon,
yeah.
You want that too?
Yeah.
Alright, that means any instrument, article, or substance which under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or serious physical injury.
What would be wrong with just simply saying was not armed with a deadly or dangerous weapon, period?
Yeah.
In light of those definitions.
Don't we get then, could not a fist be a dangerous weapon then? I mean.
Well, I was going to say, I don't know why you would worry about that, because in the last session, Carson, we passed a bill carrying out. What we wanted to do was exclude firearms from public buildings, but the bill was so sweeping that it extended to a bottle of ketchup or a can of hairspray. Remember we had that real sweeping bill right at the end of the session that we passed? And that's the two things, but the deadly weapon. I think you could argue that the fist, the fist or anything normally isn't fall in that area unless the man is a prize fighter.
Yeah, I think that the definition is about as close as you're going to come, and that we're just going to have to leave some room for courts to move around.
Yeah, the difference is between deadly and dangerous, though.
Yeah, well, the thing is, though, even if the man had a club, if he had a club in his back pocket or something, that in itself would not prevent him from invoking this defense, assuming that he didn't use the club. Because
or he didn't plan to use
it. Yeah, it's a club until such time as the manner in which it's used makes it a dangerous weapon.
Well, now, wait a minute.
We'll use and.
In D, he also has to show that there was no reasonable ground for him to believe that any other participant was armed with such weapons. So if somebody is carrying a club in his pocket, well, of course, he's not using it, though.
Yeah, but
when
he
being
armed,
armed
with
he
it.
Had a billy in his back pocket. He was
armed with it,
hanging from his belt or whatever.
Well,
readily capable.
What if under this? What if he has a billy in his back pocket? And
Is not the person raising the defense now. This is one of his accomplices. Because if he he can't.
Let's say he has it. But doesn't use it.
Oh, okay.
He's still armed with it.
He'd still be, he'd fall within the felony murder, wouldn't he? Because he would
looks
be
armed. Like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose that that's within the purview and still further narrows the defense. We don't want him armed with a deadly weapon because he's liable to use it. And if he is armed with it, he's going to disqualify himself from this limited defense. And I think that's perfectly within the purpose of this.
That's right.
Okay. Now the question is, do we extend that same reasoning, which I agree, to dangerous weapons? Because deadly weapon is identifiable.
It's inherently a weapon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's,
but dangerous
that's its purpose
is
to be a weapon.
But dangerous could be an ashtray.
Well,
right?
Well, it could be. And if you leave it the way George has it here, like he says, this is going to further narrow the defense. Because you're not going to be able to define all this myriad of different things.
I suspect this is why the Model Penal Code took its choice. Just simply saying it's a rebuttable presumption. And leaving to the courts and the juries to grapple with the actual details of what's going to be rebutting the presumption, what is going to be the defense successfully. New York has taken the position that we better list it, and if it doesn't fall in this, it's just too bad. So that's we're looking at the weakness of this kind of delineation and just becoming very specific. And as it becomes specific, it becomes a narrower defense. And I suppose the courts could pretty well invalidate the whole policy by a restricted view of the listings here.
Yeah, I mean, there are going to be certain things, certain kinds of weapons that are going to, just by nature, fall within the definition of deadly weapon. I mean, your guns.
Pistol.
Yeah, but that doesn't, like you said, that doesn't cause me the slightest bit of concern, because if the fellow has the gun, whether or not he uses it, to me, as far as the felony murder rule is concerned, I'm not impressed as a defense. But I'm worried about the question Harl raises about this instrument, article, or substance. if we substitute dangerous weapon for that definition, which perhaps would be one way to go, have we not really, as George has indicated, just wiped out the defense entirely?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think if you use dangerous weapon rather than the language George has, you're going to ease the burden on this defendant trying to invoke this defense. Because the way I read George's language, the mere fact that he has this on him is going to have to be he's going to have to establish that he didn't even have this with him, whatever it happens to be, whatever this instrument, article, or substance might be. Whereas our definition of dangerous weapon means an instrument, article, or substance which, under the circumstances in which it's used, in other words, we take it a step further and require either a use or a threatened use of this. And we follow that same reasoning, well, in robbery, for example, that it isn't first degree robbery to be armed with a dangerous weapon. But it is first degree if you use or attempt to use a dangerous weapon. Whereas it is first degree robbery if you're merely armed with a deadly weapon. That we've required some use or attempted use to get you into the first degree category.
For dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm not, the more I think about it, Wally, I'm not troubled by using dangerous, even though it's pretty broad in scope, because I'm just thinking to myself, somebody walks into a grocery store to stick it up with a toy pistol, which is not uncommon, and they're not carrying ashtrays and broken glasses and things of this sort, and if they are, then I'm not so sure that we ought to
extend
this thing to them. If they are carrying something that would be in the nature of a dangerous weapon, then the degree of violence that's liable to result is obviously higher. The terroristic effect is greater. Can't be too sympathetic, anyhow, with this kind of a defendant who's raising this defense, because he's been in on something where somebody, some poor innocent member of society, has been murdered or been killed in the process of what he has helped initiate, a robbery or rape or whatever else it is.
I have another can of worms I might throw out. It's probably just that. In regard to defenses and of a sort not ordinarily carried in public places by law-abiding citizens, couldn't this, in essence, create a double standard if you had the case and you the application of this standard to people charged in Portland and tried in Portland might be very different than that of people tried in Prineville.
Very possible. I think I'd take that language all out and just say deadly dangerous.
Yeah.
Deadly or dangerous weapons, period.
Okay, Harley,
we still have the same problem with respect to how you define dangerous weapons in some of these places, too, but that's something you just have to kind of roll
with,
I guess. You know, the Oregon Supreme Court's going to have to, or the Court of Appeals would have to deal with it, I suppose, if there's a variation.
Right, okay, in that case.
Yes.
That's a good point.
Don, do you have any comments editorially, grammatically, on how you want to substitute dangerous weapon for...
Well, the way we've used it before, we've said with a dangerous or deadly weapon.
With a dangerous... But not armed with a dangerous...
Or deadly weapon. And then we strike the rest
weapon,
of that
period,
C.
Semicolon. And
except the and would still be in there.
Strike the rest of it except for the and. Okay, do we all agree to that? Harley?
Yeah.
Tom,
I'll move it.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Haas moves that. All in favor, keep us saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Carry.
Now, sub 3 needs some attention. This relates to, it is a defense to murder, to a charge of murder, that one, now here the defense is different. This is just a straight defense that has to be introduced by the defendant. The burden remains with the state. With respect to the causing or aiding of suicide without the use of duress or deception. In other words, one who aids another to commit suicide through duress or deception is guilty of murder. Or, of course, one who kills the person who wants to die himself is guilty of murder, probably, or maybe reckless homicide. But here, if there's no element of duress or deception in his aiding by giving somebody the pills or something and they thereby kill themselves, he can't be guilty of murder if he successfully makes out his factual defense. That represents, I believe, the current law.
I was going to say,
one would not now be guilty of that, would he?
No. The situation in Oregon is unclear because it's so unusual a situation. There's only one case I could find that was at all relevant, and the facts were so different that it wasn't too helpful. But the case law elsewhere, I think, is reflected in this provision, and this reflects the Model Penal Code provision.
I wonder why that didn't raise more. I mean, even with the shotgun situation.
I've got the case cited.
Begged me to help him, and I just held a gun for him, you know. I guess maybe it wouldn't be very...
The jury
wouldn't be very receptive, perhaps. But
the State versus House, is the case in Oregon that I found dealing with the general subject of suicide. And that was a case where the wife, supposedly, the story was, the defendant's wife had asked him to help her commit suicide, and that it was all her idea, and that he was just going along with the deal, and she was ill or something. But he actually pulled the trigger in the case. So it isn't the kind of case that this is meant to cover. He wouldn't have a defense there. He, of course, might have a defense of manslaughter or something of that sort, but he wouldn't have a defense of murder because he himself was the agent causing the death by pulling the actual trigger. So the case was the only one I could find dealing with the problem, but it is kind of the situation you're suggesting, Harold. Well, I didn't do it, really. I just helped him.
So what we're going to do is put that down in the manslaughter area.
Yeah, the suicide is dealt with in a separate section here in the draft. Section 3, I guess, or 4. I can't remember what number it is. The last section in the draft.
I buy this for the mercy killing, you know, for the doctor who gives the man's 2 days away from death, and he gives him the air injection, gives him a pill. And,
no, it's in section.
That's one being the guy's in terrible agony, and he pleads with him and everything. But then the other area, it kind of rubs me wrong, you know, like the case, accepting the defendant's facts as being accurate to him. Really get right in there and get right in there and aid and abet them to commit suicide. You, of course, manslaughter is not an insignificant crime.
No, it isn't.
So that's the answer to that.
Would we all agree, turning to paragraph D on page 6, that should we eliminate the words instrument, article, or substance in light of our amendment to previous paragraph C?
Yes, you're correct.
Semicolon on weapon, and then balance leaving the and.
I think we can simply say such a weapon without.
Or you could just restate your previous language. Was not armed with a. Was not. Yeah, I think it'd be preferable to say was not armed with a dangerous or deadly weapon, rather than such.
Okay, Mr. Haas moves that amendment to no reasonable ground to believe.
This strictly is an aside. This referring to such a weapon as contrasted with saying over again what you really mean, because it's clearer. And as lawyers, we learn to do this, and because we see the need for clarity. And I read a very interesting article on the legal writing style of Abraham Lincoln, written by some Illinois attorney who had made a study of his speeches and had looked at his pleadings that were on file in the local court. And he came to the conclusion that this is where Lincoln learned the marvelous, beautiful language that he used in all his addresses, Gettysburg and everything else. Because if you notice them, he does this. He doesn't do like a lot of laymen do of saying, well, such a weapon. He'll put it back in. He'll say dangerous and deadly again, repeat himself. And it's interesting, I think. This does help in writing speeches. All you politicians take note.
I don't know these big words like
if
dangerous
you look
and
at
deadly.
If you look at Lincoln's addresses carefully, you'll see that pattern all the way through. He doesn't leave anything to doubt.
Yeah, even writing on envelopes, too.
I did that, but that really didn't help.
Okay, that's my aside for
today. Okay, Mr. Haas moves that we amend paragraph D by adding dangerous or deadly after with. Striking such a, putting a semicolon, striking the balance of the sentence, leaving the and. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, nay. Carried.
Don's going to resolve all the defense, affirmative defense problems by defining it specifically in the general definition section and then adjusting the language in these articles accordingly so that we for sure know
what
we're talking
about. Been running into quite a few problems with this. So what we're going to do is insert a section in our preliminary article on defenses, and we will define affirmative defense as the defense where the defendant must raise the issue and must establish the defense by a preponderance of the evidence. So whenever we use affirmative defense, that's what it's going to mean.
Okay.
And if we just say straight defense, I mean, he would have to still raise the issue, but the burden is going to remain with the state to disprove it, in fact.
When he under that situation, Don, when he raises it, he's allowed to raise it, and he doesn't have to prove it by a preponderance. Then is the only effect, really, is that he can get up and he can argue it, and he can get an instruction on it.
Yeah, well, it depends on what the rule is in each jurisdiction. Now, that's the flexibility that's built into this thing. How much evidence he has to put in before he gets an instruction on it is just plain state law, case law. And I think the Model Penal Code says that's the way we want to leave it. This is the kind of flexibility that you need.
He doesn't have to do much. Now, for example, the self-defense. There's an Oregon case, fairly recent Oregon case, 62, I think, which says that if there's any evidence that it's required to go to the jury, I mean, whether it's raised by the defendant or not, if there's anything in the trial that would support an instruction on self-defense, the defendant's entitled to it. So, I mean, he really doesn't...
Just some or mere, I guess, is really about all it takes.
And then our article on justification, which is before the commission right now, we got into it a little bit in our last meeting, but goes into some of these problems. And we treat all of our justification defenses as straight defenses. So it's just a matter of raising them. We're not putting any burden on the defendant in those cases. But so
one more item that I did miss that we ought that the subcommittee ought to direct attention to, because I'm sure the commission will want some response to it, and that is sub 1, sub B. It is committed murder, is criminal homicide, committed recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. Now, this is one of those kind of phrases that's going to have to be construed. This is all the definition we get.
This is going to bring negligent homicide into it, isn't it?
No. Level of culpability of criminal negligence is going to be defined clearly as different from reckless homicide. These are the patterns we're following from the Model Penal Code that now exist in other article in our code. The reckless difference being predominantly, and I'm sure you're aware of this, I'll just remind you again.
Isn't that almost the definition today of negligent homicide?
Gross negligence.
Well,
then they define gross negligence.
Our definition of recklessness is very close to what we think of as gross negligence now. It's probably a little.
It's close to criminal negligence.
That's right.
It's not close to recklessness.
That language we have now is that it.
It's still defined in terms of inadvertent risk creation. That is the gross negligence now. I believe, from reading the cases. Don, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's
right. In recklessness now, we're talking about advertent or conscious risk-taking.
Disregarding a known risk, really.
A known risk.
Disregarding, a conscious disregard of a known risk is really the way we define recklessness.
And the Oregon cases do not define it that way, I don't believe. They speak in terms mostly of tort negligence. And this is one of the improvements I think this draft, not this draft, but I mean the general definitions is going to make in criminal negligence to show that it's a much higher level than mere gross negligence in the tort sense, but it is definitely lower than recklessness as defined. And here again, when we deal with these kind of levels as defined, they're still a variable factor, and I think necessarily so, of applying in a given fact situation, that the jury does have the flexibility of deciding, well, I don't think this was criminal negligence. I think this guy deserves to be treated as a reckless homicide case.
Are we going then to deal with the negligent homicide situation elsewhere?
Yeah, in the last section. Sorry. Now, this phrase is broad, and it's a model penal code phrase. I don't think it's the choice of most other new codes, but I think it's a good one because this kind of situation that will demonstrate, I think, the difference between homicide committed intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly with extreme indifference to life. And this is kind of a hypothetical. The defendant clearly, intentionally wants to kill A. And to do this, he places a bomb in A's home. And he waits until A is going to wait to be in the home and then detonate it some way remotely so he'd be sure to get A when he's home. But A walks into his house with B, and the defendant sees B walk in with A. Now, if he blows up the house and kills A and B, he has intentionally murdered A and knowingly murdered B because he knew as a moral certainty for absolutely sure that he was going to kill B. Now, if he wants to kill A in the same fashion, and B has gone into the house previously and has not been seen by the defendant to go into the house, and yet the defendant consciously would be aware that somebody is in the house. It's a conscious risk that there's somebody going to be in that house, and he takes that. It's a dwelling place, and he knows people go in. Let's say it's a motel room or something where he knows that other people are going to be. Then if he kills B, not knowing for a certainty that he's going to kill B, then we have the reckless homicide with indifference standard.
That's covered by murder now, too.
Yeah, that's murder,
too.
The
mistaken victim, that's
intent. Mostly. That's the murder two branch now, really, of Oregon law.
We use this same kind of standard in our first-degree assault, this indifference to human life test. And I was just noting that originally, we had used extreme indifference, which I think is best or better, but
gooder.
Yeah, gooder.
Gooder.
But, and I can't recall. I'd have to go back to the minutes. It was either the subcommittee, this subcommittee, or the commission that didn't like the word extreme, and they changed it to gross. And I can't remember why it was, except they felt that there would be some...
It's 144 times better.
Yeah, they felt that there would be some case authority to help the courts construe gross rather than extreme. And so we ended up our tentative draft on assault. In first degree assault, we used the language recklessly cause a serious physical injury to another under circumstances manifesting gross indifference to the value of human life.
I'd almost be willing to bet that was commissioned, not the... because I have a general dislike, distrust, and disdain for the word gross. So,
actually, I think it carries baggage you don't want to carry.
Well, I do too, but that was...
That might have been a subcommittee. I got round heels, and I don't stand up sometimes. But the other word is manifest, but I'd kind of like to see if we get one through the commission sometime, the word manifest.
And well, we got one.
Oh, manifest, and we got assault through the commission.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well...
I unless Earl wants to change it or Tom recommends a change to extreme, I'd rather leave it but then flag it and show that we've got an inconsistency.
I think maybe we can get them to go back to extreme for assault. I think it's
you'd
better.
You'd rather give the court the new term to play with rather than
better
the old
word, yeah.
It's got all these old tort liability connotations to it.
But I think that's a strong
as I recall, the discussion was, well, what do you mean by extreme?
What do you mean by gross?
Yeah, and, well, that was it. And they said, well, at least with gross, we've got some case... definitions that we can look
at. Yeah, every time the court decides.
Where does the fellow who shoots across the highway fall?
Well, he's going to be gross. It's going to be reckless murder within sub B, or it's going to be manslaughter or criminal negligence, depending upon the facts of the case.
So
I really can't say.
If he's shooting across
the highway in a strip commercial development, obviously this sounds more like murder in the reckless sense with extreme indifference. Mm-hmm. But if he's out on a logging road somewhere where there hasn't been another human being seen for 10 years, it might not be homicide at all.
Yeah.
Even though someone is killed under our definitions. So, but here again, the jury is given with a broad definition where it can put this, how it feels about the defendant. It can put him in any of these three slots, depending on the facts.
I had one other question, George. Now, was it your feeling that murder committed under any of these three, A, B, or C, could be punished by life in prison?
Mm-hmm. Possible. Whatever the first degree felony is, I would intend for it to apply in all these cases. And I think that reflects model penal code policy, and I think general policy, the newer codes. But perhaps they're not generalized that way. They treat it differently.
Well, I agree with you there. Yeah. Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure that so that when we do get to our grading, that we don't through our penalty structure change some policy that we've got in here in our definition.
The choice that you have here is to reduce this sub B to the manslaughter category. That is, because we define in the next section manslaughter to be criminal homicide constitutes manslaughter when it is committed recklessly, period, without any of these verbs about or adjectives about extreme indifference. But that would do away with a traditional and I think useful definition of murder, which has existed for a long, long, long time, and that's the reckless murder doctrine that we now have as murder too in this state, and in most states, I guess. That is the depraved heart doctrine, you know, that old emotional phrasing. This is emotional in a sense too, because it's extreme indifference. It's just a different, more modern way of saying it, I think. So, if you want to leave this, we don't have the problem, but if you want to move it out of here, then we're going to have to think about how do you cover the present existing reckless murder doctrine. I think this covers it myself to the degree that it ought to be covered, to allow flexibility of instruction and flexibility of jury response.
Okay, any other comment on section 2? Okay, let's go on to section 3, manslaughter.
Now, the first one is rather simple. That is, overall, I'd say we're making some substantial changes here. Manslaughter is voluntary or involuntary in our present Oregon system. The present and most well-known manslaughter, of course, is the reduction of murder to manslaughter because of the action out of the heat of passion without sufficient provocation. This is the old traditional common law defense to the charge of murder, which would reduce it to manslaughter. Now, we're expanding that to get away from the old reasonable man concepts, a purely objective defense, to include or to allow the jury to consider the characteristics, physical and mental, of the particular defendant who says, "I reacted in this way because of what I am." Much more subjective application. In other words, this would encompass within it that words could be sufficient provocation. If in fact, in the defendant's situation, as he sees things, he would have reacted that way. Now, it's still a reasonable test in that the jury, we have the words, the reasonableness of it has to be a reasonable explanation. And the reasonableness of such explanation or excuse shall be determined from the standpoint of a person in the actor's situation. So we still have an objective aspect, an important objective aspect, but allowing a more subjective, individual application of this old basic concept of provocation.
This
it's a liberalization.
This kind of picks up the California situation, doesn't it? The where insanity, you may not be able to prove insanity as a defense, but you can prove
diminished responsibility.
Yeah,
we have that in the responsibility article too. But you're right; it is sort of the same idea. This isn't the mental disease or defect, however, situation that causes the person to perceive things differently. This is because he's a coward. Psychically, he's a coward, for instance. Therefore, the jury, or remember the famous, I don't know if you've heard this famous case or not, it's an English case, it's in the law school text case books all the time, where the defendant was trafficking with a whore in London, and she discovered that he was impotent, and she was making fun of him and provoking him in the sense on a very, very sensitive issue, and he wound up stabbing her to death. Well, under the provocation doctrine, that's not a defense, because what's the reasonable man do in this situation? Well, the reasonable man, the normal man, isn't impotent. So how do you make the standard apply at all? Well, this would say, what would the juror putting himself in this situation believe about the excuse? Is it reasonable? Now, he may still come up with the answer, no, it's not reasonable. But at least it allows him to take into consideration the physical aspect and the mental aspect of that particular defendant. Recklessness is defined in terms of conscious risk creation of a substantial and unjustifiable nature, which is a, by the way, gross deviation. I think the Model Penal Code uses that. Do we use it, Don?
Gross deviation?
Yeah. I've got that set out somewhere. Gosh, I hope we aren't using that word.
No, I don't think we use it.
I think the Model Penal Code does with respect to the definition of its negligence. Yeah, by golly, we do. And maybe I'm not quoting the latest one, but on page 25, no, that's in criminally negligent homicide. I quote the subcommittee draft. And with respect to criminal negligence, the draft, as least as of December 1968, said it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise.
Well,
the situation.
Yes, we may.
Recklessness, I know, I'm not sure of. I didn't quote that one. At any rate,
we do. Yeah, I'll take that back. Under our definition of criminal negligence, we use.
How about recklessness? Is that part of the recklessness thing?
Yes, the risk must be of such nature and degree that disregard thereof constitutes a gross deviation.
Of course, that's just one aspect.
From the standard of care, yeah, that's.
The risk consciously created is recklessness. And it must be a substantial, unjustifiable risk that's going to result in homicide. Now we're talking about. So that's the, and of course the third branch here of manslaughter is one we've touched on previously. That is a person intentionally causing or aiding another person to commit suicide is guilty of manslaughter. But if he uses deception or duress, then it's murder.
George,
I'm still a little disturbed about this, the reasonableness of the explanations to be determined by the standpoint of the person. Now we just have the defendant is judged by the standard of a reasonably prudent man under the same or similar circumstances. This is going to say that his standard will be determined by not necessarily a reasonably prudent man, but by this defendant and by his standards. Did he act in conformance to what was reasonable for him? That concerns me.
No, not what was reasonable for him. That's where we leave. I agree with everything you said up until then, that it's very subjective. But when it gets to the reasonableness, it's not reasonable as he saw it, but reasonable, whether is it a reasonable explanation to anybody based on those characteristics. This is where it switches into the area of objectivity again. Now it's a finer attempt at subjective defense, and I think justifiably so, because when one does not have the mens rea of murder, he ought not to be punished for murder because he is mistaken from the standpoint of a reasonable, prudent man.
Let me pose a situation and see how it fit. Let's take a defendant who was raised in the ghetto. Goes to the as a culturally deprived child, product of a divorced home. Goes to grade school and high school, such as it was, can prove that the neighborhood and community that he was raised in was there was extreme high crime rate, that it was generally accepted in the community, certain conduct such as theft, riot, things like that. And he kills a policeman. And the
facts or something, let's say he's sitting in a car and he had previously had trouble with the law, and his case states that he had been beaten by policemen before. And a police officer comes up to the car, this background, this man, he's not too intelligent, he's slow, and grabs the car door, says, "Get out of the car," and places his hand on his sleeve, and he turns and he shoots him.
All right, you're inserting an element that's not meant to be covered, and perhaps in our legislative history we want to insert it, but we're not allowing the defendant to insert his moral judgments, that is, as he ethically sees things.
Okay, well, I'm thinking more in terms of the fear.
Yeah, right. Now, in the second case, where it's fear engendered by previous police beatings, then he's entitled to present that to the jury, but whether it's a reasonable explanation would be up to the jury to decide. In taking him in his situation, the court, in other words, is going to be able to instruct, do you believe that the defendant, who has been subjected to these kind of beatings before and was of this particular mental attitude because of that, did he reasonably think that he was going to be beaten, or that is, have his serious bodily injury again? And if the jury says, yeah, it's a reasonable explanation, this kid's been beaten up 15 times by the police, then they'll say he's not guilty of murder.
Or manslaughter.
Well, yeah, he could still be guilty of a homicide of some sort.
But he wouldn't be guilty of manslaughter, would he?
Well,
that's what kind of concerns me.
This is simply the defense to murder.
Yeah, they define. Yeah.
This is all we're doing now,
manslaughter,
is reducing murder to manslaughter.
Okay.
He's not going to be excused from the manslaughter. He still would be acting recklessly, or at least with criminally negligent conduct. So what we're doing, we're trying to establish a more precise connection between the actual mens rea that results in the killing than now exists in the law. When one reacts, as the case you just posed, or the one that I posed about the fellow who's impotent, he isn't a murderer because he doesn't have the mens rea of murder as we define it, but he is obviously guilty of a homicide. But we're allowing him to reduce it if the jury believes him, if the jury's sympathetic. Heretofore, they couldn't put that kind of evidence in because it wasn't within the old provocation doctrine. It's been pointed out correctly that one of the conceptual difficulties with that old reasonable man test is that reasonable men don't kill. And it's silly to say that a reasonable man would kill under the circumstances. This would avoid that conceptual difficulty because it gets away from that old test. It says, what about this guy in this situation as he saw it? Is that reasonable?
You've very carefully explained up to the point in your example of the impotent defendant. But there is a point where you put the jury in the shoes of the defendant up until the time he makes his decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then, even though he may have rationally, as he saw it, made the decision, that is not a defense.
This is where it switches into objectivity.
Then it goes to the jury.
The jury's got to decide, was he reasonable?
So they put on the cultural, physical, emotional cloak of the defendant, but then they must reach their own decision, and not whether or not he believes.
Well, they cannot accept.
It's
they don't have
concept.
To accept what
yeah.
he believes. Now, by the way, this is very interesting, and somewhat of an aside, but it is relative to the mistake of fact doctrine, which you're dealing with in some other article. I don't know whether you've dealt with it somewhere else or not, but if you'll recall your old textbook law, If a man makes a mistake of fact with respect to a crime, and let's take it as an example, larceny. If he thinks he owns the property, well, that's a mistake of law doctrine. The same principle involves is the element of the crime itself is a specific intent, and he doesn't have it because he made the mistake. Now, that's a complete defense to crime. But we're not talking about that exactly here. A fellow may make a mistake of fact with respect to reducing murder to manslaughter, but since homicide may be committed recklessly or negligently, his mistake of fact must be reasonable as well as honest. So if there is that problem, it doesn't enter into this situation, but it's related. So we can say, that's why I say it's possible for us to say his mistake or his reaction was unreasonable in this situation, because he can still commit manslaughter. It's still possible to commit manslaughter recklessly or negligently. It's not possible to commit larceny recklessly or negligently because it's specific intent of crime.
What about this term under the influence? It would seem to me that I can that this is quite a departure from the old heat of passion idea of manslaughter.
That's right.
When it is voluntary, it would seem to me that I could have been provoked by something that was that caused me a mental emotional disturbance for which there would be a reasonable excuse from my standpoint under the circumstances, and that then, to use the old terminology, I could have deliberated and premeditated for some time before I went out and killed under the influence of this disturbance. I wonder if we're not making all our homicides manslaughter when we do this.
This goes to that very issue, and in fact would allow a cooling time if in fact it still results in this extreme upset, which is reasonable now, let's remember, reasonable within the minds of the jury as a reasonable explanation, then the cooling period deal is out too. That really doesn't serve any function in the law.
No.
Is this person, did he do what he did because of the way he is, and ought we to be sympathetic with him? Shouldn't we consider all those factors in deciding whether he's guilty of murder or manslaughter? And this provision, this concept says yes, we should allow consideration even if he thinks about it for a week. Now, obviously, it's going to be less reasonable to a jury if he thinks about it for a week when he comes up with this kind of a story. Clearly, in the old law, think about it for a week, and probably, if you think about it for more than a couple hours, it's going to be no good because it's a cooling time, the old cooling time provision.
Would this have allowed a... Would this have allowed a defense to Jack Ruby?
Oh gosh!
He had a defense anyway.
It
didn't work.
That,
but
did
that's right.
Well, sure. If I was Ruby's attorney, I'd throw it in there. I don't know how far you'd get with it, but.
You think it would be successful under this test?
I don't think it'd be successful under this test. I think a diminished responsibility would do him a lot more good because he was reacting from a mental disease or defect. It was short of insanity, as I recall. He raised that defense, did he not, and didn't make it on that. But Ruby's case was much more a case of mental disease or defect, I think, than the ones we've been posing so far.
About Sirhan.
Well, there again, these are related defenses in the sense of diminished responsibility, but I think if he's going to make any ground, it's going to be on the diminished responsibility rule rather than this one. He didn't make any ground on any of them.
No, he didn't.
One thing we've got to keep in mind, and I think we ought to remind ourselves every half hour of this, is that remember, this isn't the law. This isn't what juries are going to do. This is the standard we're setting. And you kind of get into that feeling that by God, this guy does this, that he's out for sure. Well, that's nothing could be further from the truth because the jury's going to decide about this guy. All we're trying to do is allow, all I'm trying to do with this draft or trying to sell here is simply allowing the jury to hear everything that's relevant that it's not allowed to hear now. Because of the old inflexible doctrine we have with respect to the provocation doctrine. I don't think it's going to make a difference in 99% of the cases, but it's worth it to that one guy if we have a defense that will be responsive to his case. This is the sort of humanistic attitude this commission has got to keep in mind.
Any other runs you want to make at Section 3, Carl? Tom?
Well, I can certainly see, imagine hypotheticals where I think this would be fine. For example, the father of a 10-year-old girl who is kidnapped and raped, and a suspect is captured, and the father thinks about this and gnaws at him for a week or 10 days or 2 weeks, and finally goes down and, well, they're bringing the defendant to the courtroom or something. blows his brains out. And I mean, in a case like that, you're even though this father now would undoubtedly be charged with murder, he'd probably have a good chance of getting a jury pardon on those kind of facts, and it would be certainly an ideal kind of case for a defense like this. But on the other hand, I can conjure up situations much like Sirhan, for example, where he would have an extremely good argument, I would think, that he was under the influence of an extreme mental or emotional disturbance.
Yeah, but
which he had a reasonable explanation for.
Yeah, the next one is what George is pointing out. Then the jury clicks in its value system.
Yeah, but then from the standpoint
if we stop there, I wouldn't try it. I wouldn't.
But you've got the actor's situation and the circumstances he believed them to be. Well, here's a guy who believed that Robert Kennedy was assisting the state of Israel in its war against Arabs.
He was reasonable, perhaps, at that point. But was he then reasonable, or was that an explanation or excuse for taking a man's life? And that's where I think the jury would say, well, maybe Bobby shouldn't have been in helping Israel. Maybe he's reasonable there, but to take his life for that, no, that's not reasonable.
You know, actually what we're saying is that, all right, this guy is a character. He's outside the pale, usually. He's a nut for some reason because of a characteristic. But we're still saying he's got to be a reasonable nut. Comes back to that. We'll listen to him now. We'll listen to his nutty characteristics. And if, in fact, it makes sense, we'll reduce it from murder to manslaughter. But if it doesn't make sense to us, it doesn't appeal to you as a juror sitting up in that box, it's murder. But it seems to me that the old inflexible provocation doctrine, with all its attendant... I think a situation covered by this, which would not be covered by the old provocation formula, would be where a man... We know of men who have short tempers. It's a natural course of their personality. And he's told that his wife is having intercourse with so-and-so. And he's the kind of guy that believes everything he hears, so he goes and kills so-and-so. Well, he ought to have a defense. He ought to be able to tell the jury about that and the kind of person he was. And we know now, the law generally, almost universally, is that words are not a sufficient provocation. Whether or not the wife was actually having intercourse with someone else. Now, even if the wife isn't having this kind of intercourse and the husband believes it, he ought to and would be able, under this kind of provision, to go to the jury and say, I was suffering from extreme emotional distress, and do you think it was reasonable?
For me.
Yeah, for me. And they say no.
That's what worries. I can see where it would be.
Yeah,
I mean, they're putting on his hat.
Mm-hmm. Putting on his clothes and his hat. And they're standing there looking at that situation. And they'll still say, you know, he's running. That's what I would have done.
If I were he.
Well, I wouldn't have worn the red tie that I put on, but otherwise I would have done what he did.
Could you reverse what you said before and say, you said reasonable men don't kill. Could that be reversed in this situation and say, for him it was reasonable, he wouldn't kill.
Well, he's not a reasonable man, that's what I'm saying. He's not the kind of, like the rest of us, also so even-handed and level-headed that we wouldn't kill anybody. We're the reasonable, prudent man. He's not, because he's got this psychical problem where he reacts in a different way. So therefore, we look at what the deviant, if you want to call him that.
What the standard for the deviant would be.
What's the reasonable standard for the deviant?
except for your felony murder cases, most people kill other people for a reason.
reasonable to them.
You know, I mean, you don't.
Could you get expert testimony?
Except maybe for a hired gun or a contract situation, something like that. You don't have too many murders where the killer doesn't really have some compelling reason for wanting to put this guy out of the way.
In other words, the jury is not asked, restating it a different way, the jury is not, maybe I misunderstand George, but the jury is not asked, did defendant believe he was acting reasonably? That's not the question.
The question is, given these circumstances of a bad back or you were told that your wife is in bed with another man, then you, as a juror, is the activity in your mind reasonable for a man with all these hang-ups?
I agree with your, and that's a significant perceptive difference.
Because I can follow that, but if you get to the point, did the defendant really, was he thinking he was acting rationally or reasonably? That should not be the determination of jury.
No, that's not the element.
I think that, and as you keep going back to it, this, the impotent Englishman, I think, keeps it in focus for me. The question, what you're not asked, did the Englishman really believe he was acting reasonably? That's not the question the jury asks. It's the question is, if I were impotent, then as a reasonable man, would I be inflamed and would I shoot and would I do this for him?
I think that's the one that has to be kept.
Yeah, but boy, if you lose that, you do get off in the thing.
And this still leaves the same broad necessity of the jury determining, or whoever the fact finder is, determining what is reasonable in this particular situation, and that's what's meant to be left over. But it does insert, at the very outset, subjectivity that has not, that does not now exist generally in this old heat of passion and provocation formula.
You'd always be able to have an explanation.
Yeah.
If you kill somebody, you got an explanation. And you would throw in the hopper, the background, and the mental disturbance, emotional upset. And then you would bring in your psychologist to testify. As experts, I would imagine, when you're a psychiatrist, that
going to open up that kind of evidence, I think. Of course, you might even get that in the old heat of passion.
This fellow is very, very, very wrong. He's very, very, he was upset. And I look at his background and his problems. I think that looking at everything, that, with his problems, what he did to him.
A reasonable reaction.
But your heat of passion, it's Loring's test, isn't going to let it in unless you've got the provocation and then pretty much an instantaneous or immediate reaction from the part of the killer, right? I mean, here you're going to have, as George indicated, you would be able to have a cooling period and some reflection on the part of the individual.
But if the cooling period has any sense to it, the sense to it is that the general reasonable man, once the first flush is gone, would not react this way.
Well,
that's, I guess that's why the cooling period is there. That this is what it's in the present law. The jury would then be able to, under the new one, would say, now this guy sat around for a week and stewed about this thing. Are we now going to hold that's reasonable? Would I have worried like that?
The same question under the substantive test for responsibility now. It's a control element. And under the new test, is approved. Essentially, that's what happened. The irresistible impulse doctrine doesn't mean what it says. That seems to say you got to react right away and kill, or whatever you're going to do for the crime. The control is really talking about a control, and if there's a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 month period, when you sit around and stew about it, you can still raise the responsibility insanity test because it still may be within your mental disease or defect, and it's exactly the same principle we're talking about here, except that it's not a medical, or it's not mental disease or defect directly related.
It's a subjective test.
Yeah.
To the defendant.
Well, now, under our diminished responsibility, we're requiring there that the defendant, if he's going to bring in expert witnesses, give notice.
That's right.
Whereas under this test, he could bring in psychiatrist or psychologist without notice.
But here again, are they not the only
in that situation now?
Their testimony is what is reasonable. The jury still, it's not a question of what he thought. The psychiatrist is not testifying what the defendant thought at the time, whether he thought it was reasonable or not. That's not the question.
This is a good point, Don. The commission has been worried, and the prosecution is always worried about meeting the psychiatric testimony. And we did provide, and the respondent responsibility, both in diminished and insanity, or notice if there's going to be an expert witness. Now, it's conceivable there are going to be psychiatrists brought in here at this point, too. And I really hadn't considered the situation as whether require notice by the defendant to the state if he's going to bring in a psychiatrist.
Who is burden of proof in this?
The state. Beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's going to be a every time there's a... I mean, it's going to be raised every time.
Isn't it anyway? Most of the time? Unless you just come up and stick them out, bam. Don't you have the element of manslaughter in almost all of these anyway?
But you apply the reasonable, prudent man test.
Well, we're in an area where it's more likely to bring in medical experts than it has been, I think. We could say that it's more likely that we're going to get more of this kind of testimony.
Oh, yeah, I would think that'd be a fair assumption. I don't
have any objection to putting in a notice requirement if a psychiatrist is going to be, an expert witness is going to be brought in line with what's been done already. But I think maybe we ought to give the commission an either or on that one.
Because this is really going to be quite close. Assuming you get a case where you're going to have experts, it's going to be very close to your diminished responsibility.
That's right. Yeah. Where is the diminished responsibility?
It's in
tentative draft form. We were just going over this morning. We've got the final form. We're going to start reproducing it today. It's been approved by the commission.
By the commission.
In California, in that area, do they try the diminished responsibility? That's a part of the case. Mm-hmm. It's not that.
No, they try the act first.
Yeah.
They assume sanity and try the act. But that's where diminished responsibility comes in, and that's what's defeated the bifurcated trial system, because the same evidence comes in with respect to whether he did the act on the grounds of his mental disease or defect, incapable of the act or incapable of premeditated murder because he couldn't premeditate. It's not insanity defense, it's just that it goes to the element of premeditated murder. And in effect, you try the whole insanity issue under what was supposed to have been the trial, where you don't try that at all. And this is why it hasn't worked, and this is the answer why bifurcated trials, you might as well forget about it.
Any other shots, gentlemen? Your quivers are empty or full?
I hate to think what Frank Knight's going to have to say about this.
Oh, wait.
It's going to be interesting.
You will be here to explain this.
No, I'm kind of sorry Lee wasn't here this morning, because I think he would have had some interesting reactions. Yeah. He's had some. He and Frank kind of see eye to eye.
Oh, Law and Order Johnson.
Yeah, Law and Order. All right.
Oh, I don't think this is radical, really. It may very well be that a lot of jurisdictions are doing this now under the provocation theory, allowing this stuff. You know, that's true about the old McNaughton rule. Remember, the cases in Oregon show clearly that although the McNaughton language says you can't do it, they do it.
Yeah.
They bring it in anyhow. So we may not really be making such a substantial change, although it seems like we
this is going to be
what is
going to be interesting. We have hearings.
did you find many cases on provocation? Any Oregon cases?
I can't remember whether I cited any or not. I don't recall. Let's see. I don't recall that I did. I remember this has been some time since I researched the Oregon cases, and I wish I could respond more directly. My reaction is, Don, that the cases that I did see were the traditional view of the provocation doctrine, the restricted, traditional, usual law on the subject, and that this changes that. I didn't cite any cases, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. Got a sheep of those things, I just didn't want to read them. But I certainly wouldn't want to indicate to anybody that this doesn't change the Oregon law, because it does, clearly. But this, by the way, is being followed in, I think, let's see, did I have a derivation?
Yeah, you have, yes, code 18.
I think that the policy in the new codes is following the model penal code, but I didn't make a specific note there. Yeah, let's see. California draft, which is of course down to two, but it had it. Let's see, New York.
see any in that section about it. It's been somewhere else. It's in this one.
They have it there under two.
Yeah, it's in the New York Code, as we have it. And I'm pretty sure Michigan has it too. Yeah, it's a little different language, but it's still influences extreme mental and emotional. So it's recognized in the new codes as the course of the future, Tim. How about that?
Well, with that, we can't hardly detain this.
The modern trend.
Yeah, the modern trend. Any other shots?
The gross modern trend.
Yes, yes. Okay, let's move on to... section 4.
The last section. Well, of course, nothing's been approved yet, but this is the last section to examine. This now, the significant thing here is that we have a definition of criminal negligence in elsewhere in the code, which is in cited here, General Principles of Liability, Culpability, Preliminary Draft Number 1, December 68, and I set out the definition of what criminal negligence is. There, it's an inadvertent creation of a substantial unjustifiable risk, as contrasted with the advertent creation as under recklessness. Now, this section incorporates the automobile homicide statute, and there's going to be a difference worked because of that, because this will probably be a third degree felony. It's classed as such in the Model Penal Code. And I'm just saying what it is now. I don't know what the ultimate decision will be, but at least it's not going to be the so-called indictable misdemeanor, which now exists. You're in the county jail or 3 years in prison under the 163.091, which is the automobile homicide statute. Now, the reaction will be, well, gosh, we'll never get a jury to convict if it's going to be strictly a penitentiary offense. And I set out a quote which I think answers it as well as I could, certainly, on page 27. Model Penal Code comment, I'm reading in the last paragraph about the second sentence. If the evidence does not make out a case of negligence, as negligence is defined here, criminal negligence that is, we see no reason for creating liability for homicide, as distinguished from any traffic offense that is involved. If the evidence suffices to establish criminal negligence, then the offense is, in our view, too serious for proper treatment as a misdemeanor. I guess that's what it comes down to. If it's criminal negligence, it is a felony, and if it's not criminal negligence, then it's strictly reckless driving. It's not reckless homicide, or it's not negligent homicide.
Well, that's certainly...
That's a change in policy.
Well, and certainly it's been the experience in Oregon, I think, that Oregon would be consistent with the commentary here for the Model Penal Code. It's been very difficult to get negligent homicide convictions. We had a report, I think I circulated that to the commission members, a report from the Oregon Traffic Safety Committee. They submitted a report the last session, didn't they?
It was the last one.
Yeah, but anyway, they had a complete brochure that they had done, a survey of Oregon cases on negligent homicide, and the conviction rate is really abominable. Very low. In fact, the prosecution rate's very low.
This ought not to be much different.
No, I don't think...
I think that was the big gripe.
As far as the practical effect of this, it's not going to... it's not going to have any significant impact, I would think, in that area.
Well, I agree with the philosophy of this, really. In a personal matter, if someone kills another with an automobile, and the jury says you were criminally negligent, by God, it ought not to be a one-month in the county jail offense. I mean, if it's that serious, it ought to be classified as a homicide in the sense of our classification in this draft. And if it isn't that serious, that's the old compromise verdict situation.
What's the definition of criminal negligence?
It's set out on page 25 under the summary, the inset paragraph there.
Yeah, and our latest draft has changed that definition.
This is almost the exact Model Penal Code definition, and the definition used in Michigan and New York and Illinois.
Didn't we pass a new one this time? We did something about the automobile.
My mind is too old to reflect that change. I don't know whether we did.
I don't think we did.
No, you did have a bill in.
I don't think it changes. You had a bill. In fact, I talked to Jane Gerhardt about
Brian
this.
Brian Cameron, like
and Jane had done some work.
Yeah, it didn't get any place.
No, it. She'd worked on some amendments on this bill.
Yeah.
And it finally was tabled.
I had that bill before me when I did this thing.
Yeah, because there was quite a was this prosecution thing brought up to mind that. The state police were as upset about this as anybody. They came in and testified in favor of the bill, which was a bill designed to do something in this area, but it didn't.
It wasn't amended last time.
Yeah.
No, that bill died. I can dig that out there if you'd like to have it. Take
it was a pretty bad attempt at whatever it was.
Well, what they were trying to do, they were trying to tie in culpability under that. Under the negligent homicide with a violation of a traffic ordinance, I think, was where they got hung up, trying to make that one means of coming within the definition of negligent.
Yeah, okay. That's a beautiful starting point for the other aspect here. This is really a misdemeanor manslaughter doctrine that they were trying to do in that bill. Any violation of a traffic ordinance would just...
That resulted in the death of another person would have been brought within the purview of negligent homicide. I think that's what they really got
hung
up on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't remember it well
enough,
but
this draft is absolutely opposed to that kind of reaction, and it does away with the old misdemeanor manslaughter rule in the sense that we look now under the homicide article at the act that constituted the misdemeanor. Now, there are all kinds of examples of misdemeanor acts. The battery that's of a very violent nature is a misdemeanor still, which may, because of its nature, naturally tend to result in death. It's a violent kind of act. All right, we look at the action by the defendant as he assaulted the person.